questions at the end of the class yesterday. So I encourage people to ask me during the class so that I think other people will benefit from it, I'm sure. So are there any questions from yesterday? Okay. So I'll start just by very briefly highlighting a couple of points I made yesterday, and then kind of starting developing the theory more systematically. So I just want to touch on a couple of points that we said yesterday. So what we saw is that CFTs are central to the study of quantum field theory. And in turn, of course, quantum field theory is central in many areas of physics, like particle physics, statistical mechanics, condensed matter, cosmology, even mathematics. And conformal field theory, in some sense, is behind quantum field theory. More directly, what we saw is that the infrared limit of any quantum field theory gives rise to a conformal field theory. So there are kind of universal objects that exist in the extreme infrared limit of any theory. And two, and another reason why they're important, even if you only care about massive quantum field theories, is that a massive quantum field theory, by massive means, it means that in particular it's not conformal invariant. Can be thought of in the following way, as some deformation of a conformal field theory by relevant operators. So it's a deformation of a conformal field theory by relevant operator. So obviously, understanding the conformal field theories is a first step in understanding the space of quantum field theories. Okay. One thing that we saw is that conformal field theories can have multiple ultraviolet short distance realizations. So one of the main theories that we will care about, that there has been a lot of progress in recent times, and I want to tell you a little bit about how this progress was achieved. It's actually not very complicated to explain. I mean, I can do it in 1 week, I think. Is the three-dimensional Ising conformal field theory. So this is some abstract object that exists in three dimensions that has a certain operator content, and that can be arrived at from this point of view of RG flows in several ways. So one way you can get it is by, you can start from a short distance, so we're going to be in the UV, and then we flow to the infrared. But you can start with some lattice Ising model. So it has a Hamiltonian with the nearest neighbors interactions. Yeah, I don't know how to draw a three-dimensional lattice, but I think you know what I mean. So there's some coupling between nearest neighbors, coupling between spins. And then by tuning the theory J to J critical, you hit a point in which the correlation length diverges, and there is a conformal invariant theory living there. And this conformal invariant theory is precisely what we call the 3D Ising CFD. Then we saw another continuum ultraviolet definition of how to reach the Ising CFD, which was this Wilson-Fisher approach, in which you study with a lambda phi to the 4 theory at very short distances. Yes?
Do you need like an external field or something to tune?
You can add that operator. That operator is both here and here. I will discuss it in a minute. You can add a magnetic field.
If you just tune G, J, and everything is just proportional to J, then what does the value of J matter? It's just a rescaling of your energy.
No, but if you look at the correlation functions, like if you look at the spin-spin correlation function, generically it will have exponential decay with the distance, except for a very special value of J. This is the same in the two-dimensionalizing model. Why are you? This, yeah, so there's one parameter, which is J over temperature, and you have to tune that. I mean, I think you're concerned that you can rescale J. This theory, as defined, is not scale invariant, right? It's only, you recover only scale invariant at a very particular point, at J equals JC. This theory is definitely not scale invariant. And then we had this Wilson-Fisher definition where we define a lambda phi to the fourth theory in 4-epsilon dimensions, which so that we can construct some perturbative fixed point that defined a conformal field theory. And in a regime where lambda star, the value of the coupling at the fixed point was perturbative, so we could trust our computations. And then by doing some analytic continuation from epsilon very, very small to epsilon 1, this was argued to be in the same universality class as the three-dimensionalizing model. Okay. So one of the things that we want to do here is to free ourselves from the ultraviolet definition of the CFT and try to study directly this object that exists intrinsically, irrespectively of any UV definition, okay? And essentially, we want to understand what constraints conformal symmetry and unitarity and so on imposes on the conformal field theory itself without ever relying on any UV definition or Lagrangians or anything, okay? So that's one of the goals we will find. So now let me, just to see that there is some relation between these things. So something that's known from Monte Carlo simulations, for example, of the 3D Ising model, is that at the critical point, so the Ising conformal field theory has an infinite number of operators, an infinite number of primaries. Tomorrow we will see what this word means, primary. But there are two relevant ones. So relevant means that the dimension of the operator has which property in three dimensions?
Related to the dimension, to the mass dimension of the operator?
Yeah, so what should the mass dimension of an operator be in three dimensions for it to be relevant? Smaller than three, yeah. So there are only two relevant operators in the Ising CFT. And then you have an infinite number of other ones. So you have an operator people call sigma, and that people call epsilon. This guy, and now you can use in Monte Carlo, and actually much, much better using the conformal bootstrap, which is one of the things I want to describe. You can measure what the dimension of this operator extremely reliably. And the dimension of this operator is something like 0.51. And this is called the spin operator for obvious reasons. And this is the energy operator, which is roughly like sigma square. This guy has dimension 1. OK? Yes?
What's the physical meaning of this dimension of the operator? Like,
yes, OK. So remember that yesterday I said that if you study the thermodynamic quantities of a statistical mechanics model, they blow up with certain critical exponents.
Yeah.
Those critical exponents are directly, remember I said that the scale invariants relate all the critical exponents to two quantities. The two quantities that measure all the critical exponents are precisely delta sigma and delta epsilon. So this tells you how, for example, the heat capacity blows up as you approach the critical point. It's given by an elementary function of sigma, delta sigma and delta epsilon. So that's a physical meaning. Another physical meaning, more direct physical meaning, is that, for example, sigma epsilon is measured if you take the two-point function of a spin one at zero and one at x. If you wish, the definition of delta sigma is precisely how the correlation function decays as a function of the separation. So this defines delta sigma. But more physically, in terms of thermodynamic thingies, like heat capacity, whatever, all of that stuff, scaling relations fix everything in terms of the dimension of the two relevant operators of the Ising model. Is that clear? Yeah. So one of the things that we will derive tomorrow is we will derive why the two-point functions of primary operators have a power law behavior like this, and why do we? I mean, it's obvious why we call this the dimension, right? Because if I perform a rescaling, you have to rescale sigma in some way so that it's invariant. That's the meaning. Now you can try to ask. So imagine you were very naive and you were trying to study Wilson-Fisher directly in three dimensions. So you would want to associate in this Wilson-Fisher realization some operator to sigma and to epsilon. So which operator would you associate in the Wilson-Fisher theory to sigma? So sigma is the thing that is the operator that couples to the magnetic field. So how would you turn on a magnetic? How would you mimic turning on a magnetic field in the Wilson-Fisher theory? Remember that the intuition is roughly that phi has to do with the spin. Okay. So what you would do is turn on an operator that's linear, well, which is phi. Okay. So if you were very naive, what is the canonical dimension, the free dimension of a scalar field in three dimensions? No? What did you say? Maybe I didn't hear it well.
One half.
Yeah, so you see that actually, if you were very naive, this is pretty close to this. So one would say, okay, this is a free theory. But actually, so another question, but it's not. So now, which operator would you assign to epsilon? In some sense, changing epsilon is moving you away from the fixed point. It's like deforming the temperature. So this is the same as giving a mass that we should correspond to phi squared. But you see already that in the free theory, so delta zero in the free theory would be 0.5, and phi squared would be 1. But you already see that the actual dimension of the Ising model is 1.5, which is very, really very far from 1. So this is one way of seeing that the Ising CFT is strongly coupled. There is no sense in which is described by a nearly free Gaussian theory. Okay. Question for you. So I can also write down another operator. I don't have space. So here we said that it's 1/2. Phi squared is 1. So I can also consider the phi to the 4 operator. Okay, given the physics picture that we had yesterday of how you go from the Gaussian free field point to the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, what can you tell me about the dimension of phi to the 4 at the fixed point? So can you tell me something qualitative about this?
Asking about a mass dimension at the point. What does the point matter?
Well, I mean, at the fixed point.
What does the value of your parameters matter for your dimension?
Oh, it matters a lot. I mean, in perturbation theory, if you were doing perturbation theory, you would compute the scaling dimension, this gadget, by doing Feynman diagrams, and then what you would get is a delta sigma would be 1/2 plus some one loop correction. It would be a function of lambda at the fixed point.
So you're asking about scaling dimension.
The scaling dimension. No, scaling dimension. Scaling dimension. I mean, someone can try to give me a feeling what should happen to the scaling dimension of of 5^4 in the, at the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So remember this picture? OK, so we have this picture, right? So we start with a Gaussian theory. So a free scalar field is a conformal field theory. And then we went to 4 minus epsilon, and we noticed that there was an RG flow. Like that. And this was the Gaussian, and this was the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. And the RG flow was precisely triggered by a lightly relevant operator that we constructed by going to 4 minus epsilon dimension, which is exactly the 5^4 theory.
So the answer is zero.
No, it's not zero, because roughly speaking, what's happening is that you have this operator was relevant near the Gaussian fixed point, right? So remember that the dimension of this guy was, the scaling dimension of this guy was epsilon. But here, but the point I want to make, okay, is that whether an operator is relevant or is irrelevant depends around which fixed point or conformal field theory you evaluated. So near this fixed point, 5^4 is a relevant operator. So it wants you to flow away from the fixed point towards infrared. While here, since it's where it ends from this point of view, from measured with respect to this fixed point, the scaling dimension has to be irrelevant, because flowing to the infrared brings you back to the fixed point. So what this means is that this guy has to have dimension bigger than 4. Sorry, bigger than 3. Was this clear, or was it completely opaque? One point to make is that if you have an RG flow between two CFTs, what's relevant in the ultraviolet becomes irrelevant in the infrared, almost by definition. And this is something that you see actually in the Monte Carlo simulations of the Ising model, that there is an operator that is kind of the counterpart of that, that it's irrelevant. OK, maybe this was, yes?
So I want to avoid more confusion in my head. When we were talking about relevant and irrelevant operators,
yes,
we made reference to the mass dimension, at least when I started with the UV. But now we're talking about irrelevance or relevance in the scaling dimension.
It's the same thing.
Oh.
It's the same thing.
Okay.
It's really measured by this quantity.
Is the same quantity, or is you mean that it's the same thing in another sense? I know.
So tell me the two versions you have.
Like when we started, we have.
So remember, I said that the dimension essentially was defined.
Yes.
By the coefficient. Well, essentially. Okay, so. Okay, I'm not sure I understand your. Try to parameterize your confusion.
I think I'm confusing.
Yes.
If I confuse the mass dimension and the scaling dimension, are those two different concepts?
It's slightly different. So
yeah.
the scaling dimension is really this, okay?
And we can also talk about relevant and irrelevant operators because of their scaling dimension,
yes.
And also because of their mass dimension.
But they're related, because remember we were measuring the scaling dimension by measuring the coefficient of the beta function.
Okay, yeah.
So that measures the rescaling with respect to some mass scale.
Okay.
It's essentially a response with respect to changing scales or length or mass scale.
All right.
I think it will become more clear once tomorrow we prove that the correlation functions in, say, the two-point function of operators in CFTs are determined by this single one number that tells you how much you have to rescale the operator when you rescale spacetime.
Okay.
So now, the goal that we want to do is essentially use conformal symmetry. Remember, the main point is that now we're going to forget about this ultraviolet stuff, and we're going to focus on the CFT in the infrared. So we want to use conformal symmetry to say as much as we can, just using the immense symmetry that conformal field theories have, the conformal symmetry, to essentially constrain observable. So the basic observables that we will care about will be the endpoint function of local operators. So we're going to have our space-time, and we're going to insert operators at various points. And we want to measure the correlation function of this operator. And one very remarkable thing that we will see in CFTs, just one second, is that the endpoint functions in a CFT are completely determined in terms of two and three-point function. So this is a remarkable statement. So that's definitely not the case in a Poincaré invariant field theory. But conformal symmetry essentially tells you that if someone hands you the data for the two and the three-point functions, there is an algorithmic way fixed by symmetry to construct any endpoint function. Yes, you had a question.
Yes, so I'm still confused about that stuff. You say that there's some relation between mass dimension and scaling dimension, but what relation?
Well,
it's not the same thing, right? Like, a mass dimension is not dependent on what point you're at. It's the mass,
Yes, yes. No, in that sense, yes, but there is a notion of when you have an operator and you rescale lambda x, there is a notion of what happens to how this operator responds to such rescaling.
Yes.
And this guy always means this, okay? So.
Okay, but that's the scaling dimension.
Scaling. So I maybe not being very. Whenever I mean dimension, I always mean scaling dimension. I mean.
You did say that they are
well,
almost the same thing. In what sense are they? What does that mean?
Well, it means the following way. So take an operator that has so let's be here, okay? So let's say this guy has because I mean I call it as mass dimension because when I rescale x by lambda, okay, this is about let's call it g. This transforms as the inverse of a mass or momentum. In that sense, I call it mass dimension because I'm asking how O delta responds under that.
But that whole thing together, you want to add that as a term to your action, so that whole thing has to be dimensionless.
Yes, so that way, that
so the mass
classically
actually plays a role there. But how exactly?
Yes,
it seems like you're saying they're equal, but they're not. They can't be equal. The mass dimension does not depend on your parameters.
The scale, okay, the mass dimension does not depend on
yes.
parameters, but the dimension of delta does.
Yes, so what does it mean to say that they have anything to do with each other?
Classically, they do, right? So let's go through this exercise. So if I do this rescaling and I want to make this thing dimensionless in the way that you would call dimension, right? Let's try to make this dimensionless.
Yes, so that's a term in your action. So that
yes.
has to have mass dimension zero.
Yeah, so what mass dimension would you assign to G to make this dimensionless?
That
yes.
depends on the mass dimension of O.
Well, that's why I put a delta. That you
it's
see
the scaling dimension, not your mass dimension.
No, that's
no,
the mass dimension.
Since when is delta the mass dimension?
Look, can we discuss it? This is a derailing of nomenclature, I think, really. I'm happy to discuss it more privately if it's not completely clear. Okay, so that's the thing that we want to do. We want to see how conformal symmetry constrains endpoint functions in conformal field theories. And how consistency conditions actually put constraints, algebraic constraints on the correlation functions that we can, in some sense, solve in special cases. Okay. Very good. So what I want to do now is to really start with, in a sense, the kinematics of conformal symmetry. Okay. So this is just pure geometry, and then we will study how operators or how physics, how to put physics on these kinematics. So remember that what I said, that a conformal transformation is a space-time transformation. So a coordinate transformation that has the property that let me see which that it preserves it rescales the line element by some arbitrary function of x. Okay. So this transformation has the property that preserves angles or preserves light cones. That's another way of saying it. So what does this mean in practice? So let's be in practice what this means. Let me do it in flat space. It means that eta mu nu dx mu dx nu equals eta mu nu or d. Let me see where I put my sigma, just to. Just so I follow my note. I'll use either omega or e to the sigma, it doesn't matter, okay? So this is just exactly the statement that I do a coordinate transformation that rescales my line element by some scale factor. Okay. So you can write this in a way that will look less weird. Okay, so a conformal transformation will be a diffeomorphism that obeys this equation. Now, if eta was 1, so for eta equals 1, we know what the solution to this equation is in flat space, is the Poincaré transformation. Okay, so we know what you are. So x tilde mu is a mu plus, so you got a translation and a Lorentz transformation. Okay, but now we allow for a general function of x. Okay, so now what I want to do is study this equation. So we want to analyze this equation for transformations connected to the identity. So these are transformations that map one point, any point, to a nearby point. Okay. So the way we do that is that such transformation can be linearized. So it's a transformation that doesn't do anything, right? That's what it means that it's connected to the identity, plus a small part. So you can think of this as some vector field that moves you from x to x tilde. OK? And now we want to solve, we essentially want to find out which vector fields satisfy this equation. So which are the vector fields that generate conformal transformation. Okay. So the first thing to realize from here is by taking the determinant of this equation, what you find is that omega is essentially the determinant or the Jacobian of the transformation to the power 1 over d. Okay. Just by taking the determinant of this equation, we're in d dimension. So, and an infinitesimal transformation, this means that this is 1 plus 1 over d. Is this clear? All I'm doing is I'm doing a linearized conformal transformation. OK? So now, plugging this infinitesimal transformation into the definition of conformal transformation, we find the following differential equation. Okay. So one thing to notice is that this sigma, sorry, this omega that appeared here, well, it's completely fixed in terms of the diffeomorphism that you have. So this is not an independent parameter; it's fixed in terms of it. And this is the equation that tells you the functions psi of x that have the property that they rescale the line element. And this equation, you may have seen this equation when it's equal zero. When it's equal zero, it's called the Killing vector equation. When it's like that, it's called the conformal Killing vector equation. Okay. One thing I should have said is that intuitively, you can see that if I define a matrix lambda of x to be dx dx tilde, so it's a matrix within this is mu nu times omega, that this matrix is orthogonal, but it's exact dependence, right? What this means is that this quantity, which is what implements the transformation, a conformal transformation can be thought of locally as a local rotation times a local dilatation. Okay. So conformal transformation is a local. Local means it depends on x. Notice that if this was a Lorentz transformation, lambda is a constant, right? It's just a constant parameter. Here it depends on x. So conformal transformation is a local Lorentz transformation combined with a local with a dilatation. Okay. So now you have to solve this equation. I don't think, given the time, I don't think I want to do it in the blackboard. It's a slight generalization of solving this equation equals zero for the case of for the case of isometries. I'll just draw a parallel, and you can just get it by taking derivatives of these equations and rearranging them. For the case of isometries, so when the right hand side is zero, by taking derivatives of this equation, you can prove that the Killing vector field is annihilated by two derivatives in space-time. So that tells you that psi is at most linear function of x. Okay. For conformal transformations, so I'll leave this an exercise for you to show, is that the conformal Killing vector is now annihilated by not two derivatives, but by three derivatives. So the most general conformal transformation is the most general vector field that you can write down, which is quadratic in the x's. Okay. So by writing down the most general expression which is quadratic in the coordinates and plugging it back into the differential equation, you find that that a conformal transformation in the dimensions, a conformal transformation is parametrized by 1/2 d plus 2 d plus 1 parameters. So if you wish, there are this number of independent conformal Killing vectors. Okay. Something very special happens in two dimensions, where the number of conformal Killing vectors is infinite, in fact. And this follows rather easily by just looking at this equation for d equals 2. So for d equals 2, you see that something very special happens. So this is for d different from 2. In d equals 2, by just playing a little bit with this equation, you will find that zeta. So a conformal Killing vector is any holomorphic function. So you have an infinite number of symmetries, and that's why two-dimensional conformal field theories are extremely constrained, and you can essentially solve them just by pure thought. Okay, so now let's write down the most general. So we know that the conformal Killing vector is the most general vector that is at most quadratic in the coordinate. Now let's write the parameterization. So, and identify what the different transformations are. So you have a term that is order zero in coordinates. You have a term that's linear in coordinates, actually two terms that are linear in coordinates. So let me write and then we will explain. Okay, so this parameters A, omega, lambda, B are precisely the parameters that control that label the different vector fields. This transformation you're familiar with is just translation. This is a Lorentz transformation. What is this? What is this?
Scale.
And this very weird one, which is kind of nonlinear, quadratic in X. It's called a special conformal transformation. Okay. And if you count, you'll see precisely that there is that number of equation. Good. So now that we have a collection of vector fields that generate certain space-time symmetries, you can compute what algebra. So you can compute the conformal algebra. I mean, the same way that if I give you the vector fields associated to Poincaré transformations, you can derive the Poincaré algebra by studying the commutator of vector field. I can do the same thing here. So essentially, what you have to do is you take two vector, okay, so vector field, let's call zeta 1 will be zeta 1 mu d mu, zeta 2 mu d mu. And I want to see what happens when I look at the commutator of two vector fields. You should, of course, get another vector field. And this vector field, if you look at the components of this vector field, okay. So this vector field is completely determined in terms of the other. Okay. But now, if I start with two vector fields that have these parameters that parameterize the different transformations. Then you can determine the transformations that you get in these commutators by essentially doing the following. So you associate to the transformation A mu. This is a generator that we call P mu. To omega mu, we associate the Lorentz transformations. To lambda, we associate B, and to B mu, the special conformal generator. So this is dilatation. And this is a special conformal generator. So by playing these games, I don't know how much I should write. You can derive the conformal algebra. Maybe I should do it once. is this procedure clear? How would you would extract the algebra in the Killing vector field? Or is this too abstract?
It's not.
It's not clear?
I'm talking online.
Okay. So that means that we should do an example, maybe? Okay, so let's do, for simplicity, Poincaré. We have a vector field, a mu. So for Poincaré, we're going to have this vector field, right? Let's put it, okay, let's call it a mu. Now, okay, so what happens if I do C pi, if I commute two vector fields that generate a translation, what will you get? You get zero? Okay, so this tells you that P mu is zero. Now let's check what happens if I do, and this will have to help me. I'm computing the Lie bracket of Lorentz transformation with a translation. So now you see that you'll get something interesting. So when this guy gets here, you get nothing, right? Because the coefficient is constant. But when this guy acts here, you get something. So let's see. There are too many mu's. I'm going to make a mess probably with it, but let's see. You're going to get something like a mu omega. Let's call this, so I don't confuse myself. Lambda, so if I differentiate this, I get delta lambda nu. Let's see, so if I act here.
We get a delta mu. We are hitting the.
Oh, sorry, I get a delta lambda here. And I'm missing, I have to soak this in the nu somehow.
Aren't we hitting?
Oh, sorry, this is like that.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, but what is this? This is a constant vector field, right? So this tells you that this is a translation. So this is psi 3 of p. Where the translation is by a parameter a mu omega mu. Sorry, a lambda. That's clear? So this tells you that if I do m mu nu p rho, you get eta mu rho p nu, and then since this guy is antisymmetric, right? When you lower the two indices of omega, so one thing that follows from the Killing vector equation is that if you lower the two indices, this guy is antisymmetric. So from here, you get two contributions. You have to antisymmetrize in mu and nu, essentially. Okay. So these are purely a geometrical way of deriving the, so if you know the the killing vector fields associated to a space-time transformation, you can derive the algebra that they generate by looking at the Lie bracket. Okay? And by doing this for the killing vector field, you recover the Poincaré algebra. So if you did now, you would get, which should be clear, because if I do the commutator of two of these guys, there's always going to be a term which is linear in X. So that's going to tell you that you can get a rotation. Okay. Is this clear? OK. So now you can do exactly the same thing. You know what the vector field associated to its generator is. I just pulled it out. So you can look at the Lie bracket of everyone. So you're going to get, of course, some measures right at 1. You get Poincaré, so I'm only going to write the non-zero ones, of course. So this guy, I think we already saw. OK, if I'm careful, and this is a matter of a bit of conventions, but let me just, whether you put an I or not, but let's. Okay, and then you have to add terms that anti-symmetrize in mu and nu and rho sigma. Do I need to write them, or is it clear how to do that? Okay. Now, many of the commutators are essentially fixed by Lorentz covariance. So one thing that you will immediately see is that that just like P is a vector. I mean, the fact that the commutator of P with the Lorentz transformations is non-zero is a statement that P is a vector. So of course, K will also transform exactly the same way, just a statement that it's a vector under Lorentz transformations. Sorry, here I should have called this. It should be mu. OK. Now I'm going to write the most important ones that we care about is a statement that D, and this we can check very explicitly, so that this guy gives you this. Okay. So that one way to think about it is that P carries charge under dilatation, okay? And K also carries charge under dilatations, and they carry opposite charge because the sign is different. This should remind you a little bit of the, when you have the harmonic oscillator and you have something like this. Okay? So you should think as P as a raising operator of dilatations. This makes sense intuitively again because P is ddx. So under the scale transformation, it increases it. Well, this equation tells you that K lowers the dimension. Okay. So when we construct representations of the conformal algebra, P and K will be the raising and lowering operators, just like A and A dagger, the raise and lower the energy in the harmonic oscillator. Or if we were doing SU2, we would have J plus and J minus, which raise the eigenvalue of J3 or and lower it. And is it, OK, why don't we do this exercise? So can someone come to the blackboard and compute this using the vector field? No, really, this will be very good. Someone, anyone. You'll get a prize. I don't know what it is, but please. Don't make me pick some. I'll pick it on random, it's much worse. I know you want to volunteer, yeah.
All right. Do it.
So, what I'm a little bit confused is that, okay, so by a dilation, I'm sending this guy, or let's call it like lambda to this guy.
No, notice that it was x tilde was going to x plus that guy.
Yeah, yeah. I want to find that thing. How can I write that in?
Okay, let's try it. But we're doing an infinitesimal transformation.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, if I think about an infinitesimal transformation, let's say I have a point x is my origin, I have x here, and a dilation is going in the radial direction, it's going to.
Well, it's homogeneous, there is no radial.
It's going to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To that thing. So, I'm going to see how I can write. So, I would write it like. And this, I will do it.
Mm-hmm.
Oops.
No.
No. Okay.
Now I'm gonna.
Why not? Because
I already wrote for you with the vector field, right? So. Do you get that?
Okay.
Scale transformation was something, let's call it alpha x mu, right?
Okay.
So if I make a infinitesimal one, that means that alpha is 1 plus lambda, let's call the lambda very small, x mu. So this is x mu plus lambda x mu. And this guy is precisely the vector field zeta mu, right? So so look at the definition.
Okay.
So now try to see what happens to the commutator of dilatation and translation.
Yeah, okay. So then, what I'm gonna do is, translation.
Okay. Dan, I think this will have to be an exercise.
Yeah. It's difficult to do in front of everybody. Alone in my.
The privacy, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's good to.
We're all going to close our eyes.
They're going to keep staring at him.
Okay.
People can help him.
Yeah, you can help me.
Then you have to look at how those things work on x mu, as in like. So it's like d b mu minus b mu d. Works on x mu by replacing
like
one plus
one
epsilon
the,
d.
One of the guys is going to hit this thing like this, let's say. So I will get a lambda to be a nu. That will be one of the terms in the commutator, and now I have to get the other one, right?
So what do you get in the other one?
Let me do it.
The other one?
0 because a is a constant.
Listen to your friend.
I just did.
Yeah, I mean, when you take the derivative of a mu, it's done.
You're saying that I get just this?
No, you get zero, right? Because when you take the derivative, now the derivative acts on a.
Okay.
And a is constant, so you just get that.
All right.
So this is precisely, what is this? It's a vector field with a constant parameter, which is a translation.
Okay, so that is that.
Okay.
All right.
It's slightly more trivial, but more, you can try to also D with K, but okay, not by number. Okay. Thank you. So you say something that's not difficult, but just, it's a good exercise for you to develop some intuition about. I forgot to write perhaps the, so these two are important for when we discuss representations of the conformal algebra, because this will define representations. It will be representations that have a definite. We're going to diagonalize, the name of the game in conformal field theory is to diagonalize the spectrum of D, the dilatation operator. This is precisely the operator that measures the scaling dimensions of the operators that we were struggling with before. Okay, so this is the guy that we care about, and we want to construct representations of the conformal algebra, and they will be labeled by the dimension of what's called the lowest weight, which is the state that has the lowest dimension in a family. Just like in angular momentum, you have a lowest weight state, and you construct the representation of angular momentum with acting with J plus. Okay? So it's going to be exactly the same. And the thing that's missing is to look at the commutator of P mu with K mu. So this you should also check. If you look at the commutator of translation with a special conformal, you get a dilatation and a Lorentz transformation. Okay. So this generates some Lie algebra. You can, by construction essentially of the Lie bracket, this satisfies the Jacobi identity. So this gives rise to a Lie algebra. And we know that the dimension of the Lie algebra, because I told you how many independent generators this we have. So it's 1/2 d plus 2 d plus 1. So given the time, I will not do it. But you can, by combining the generators in a slightly clever way, essentially, the conformal algebra, which we wrote in terms of these various generators, is SO2, D if we are in Lorentzian Minkowski space, or SO1, D plus 1. OK, so Minkowski means R1, D minus 1, and Euclid if we are in R, D, okay? And one way you can make this explicit, I'll leave you this as an exercise, is that you can combine these generators into the generators of SO2, D. The generators of SON in general, it doesn't matter on the signature, are always antisymmetric, okay? So SON, so you have generators LMN, where M goes from 0 to D minus 1, but these are just usual Lorentz space-time coordinates, and you add two more. We're going to call D and D plus 1, OK? And these guys, by definition of what it means that you have an SO2 algebra, will obey an algebra which is essentially identical to the Lorentz algebra, MP, NQ, plus terms that are fixed by the antisymmetry in MN and LQ. And this eta is the usual metric, but now we'll have two negative eigenvalues and d positive ones if we're in Lorentzian signature, and we'll have one negative and d plus one positive if we're in Euclidean signature. And the way that you can relate these guys to our generators we discussed there is through this relation. So when mu and nu go over the usual space-time directions, which are these, you identify those with Lorentz generators. If you look at the d, d plus 1, which are sort of the two extra coordinates that we added, you get a dilatation. L mu d, you get one combination of p mu plus k mu. And L mu d plus 1, you get the other combination. So what you can show is that given those commutation relations and giving these relations, it follows that the L's through this relation obey this, which proves that the conformal algebra is this or this. Okay. Should I tell you about? I think I have to tell you about inversion. Maybe I can tell you this tomorrow. I have to tell you something for the homework today. So this was a study of the most general conformal transformation connected to the identity. There can be transformations that are not connected to the identity. Okay, that in fact there are transformations like that already in the Lorentz group. Can someone tell me an example of a Lorentz transformation that's not connected to the identity? Time reversal or parity. Okay. And so in conformal transformations, there are also transformations that are not connected to the identity. And in particular, there will be an important one that we will use a lot, which is called inversion, which essentially maps the region inside the unit sphere to outside. Okay. And again, so the just like in relativistic quantum field theory is invariant under the connected component of the Lorentz group, sometimes called the proper orthogonal subgroup of the Lorentz group, a conformal field theory must be invariant under the connected part of the conformal algebra, of the conformal group. And it may or may not be invariant under inversion, under discrete transformation. And we will maybe see more of that later. Okay. So all this was kinematic, just if you wish, some way of deriving the most general conformal transformation. And now, but now we want to connect to physics. So a conformal field theory, by definition, is a theory that has these symmetries. So now we want to say what can we say, what properties does a quantum, what I want to discuss now briefly is what properties does a quantum field theory must have in order for it to have symmetry in hands from Poincaré to conformal field theory, okay? So let's start with Poincaré. So in any Poincaré invariant theory, there must be one operator which is conserved. Which operator is that? The what? No, I cannot hear you.
Energy.
Yes, the energy momentum tensor, more generally speaking, yeah. And in any Poincaré invariant field theory, you always have a conserved energy momentum tensor, and you can always make it traceless. Sorry, asymmetric. Okay, now we want to ask what, and this makes sense because Tim, you know, if you think of deriving, there are several ways to think about the energy momentum tensor. By far the most convenient one is to think of it as the response of doing coupling the theory to a small deformation in space-time and seeing how the system responds to that. So now I want to understand what properties does Timino must have to be dilatation invariant and a special conformal invariant. Okay, so now let's see that. Okay, so what is the energy momentum tensor? As I said, it's a response. What you can do is you have your theory. We only care about flat space here, but you can couple your theory to an arbitrary background as a way of measuring the response to the theory to that perturbation and read off the energy momentum tensor. So the energy momentum tensor is something like this. Okay? And now you want to see the following. So if the theory is okay, so now let's do a particular under the diffeomorphism, the metric transforms like this. In flat space. That's just what how the metric you've seen this probably in the GR course that under the diffeomorphisms, the metric transforms with the Lie derivative, okay? This way? Is this clear or not? Because otherwise, I will have to stop and explain this. Okay. But now for a conformal transformation, we saw that, okay, you saw before that a conformal transformation is precisely one in which is was proportional to some eta mu nu And essentially, so just by, OK, so. Right? That was what the conformal transformation was. So this T mu nu is a variation. Sorry, this delta H mu nu is a variation under arbitrary diffeomorphism. And under a conformal transformation, which is the transformation that we want to see with our theories invariant under, it is of this form. So we want to probe whether our theory is invariant under a conformal transformation. So all I do now is I plug this into here. I plug 1 and 2 into there. And what I get is that this is, forget, I mean, the factors of 2, don't worry about it. Doesn't matter for this argument. What you're going to get is that you get P mu mu. OK, let me write in 2 steps. So you get something like times eta mu nu. Is this clear? I just plugged in the fact that under a conformal transformation, delta H mu nu is proportional to the metric itself times some scale factor. Okay. Now, what is this? This is just a trace of the energy momentum tensor, which we write as P mu mu delta derivative of zeta. Okay. So now we're ready to ask, under what conditions should the energy momentum tensor of your theory have in order for it to be, first of all, a scale invariant? OK, can someone tell me what, given what we've discussed, what properties should P mu mu have in order for the theory to be scale invariant?
Tracer?
That's sufficient? I mean, that's, yeah. That will do it, but you need something weaker than that.
OK.
Needs to integrate to zero.
OK, so what does that mean? As an op- I mean, so translate this word into math. OK, it means?
What's not math about integrating to zero?
No, well, no, because tell me what T mu mu is then. What is it?
You mean that it's a total growth?
Yes, that's what I was, yes. Because notice that for a dilatation, for a scale transformation or a dilatation, delta zeta is a constant, right? So this will vanish. OK, so if it's a symmetry, it means that the action, or more precisely, the partition function is invariant under the transformation. So this guy will be invariant if this guy is a total derivative, OK? And under a conformal transformation, special conformal. OK, so now what should the energy momentum tensor obey so that it is invariant under a conformal, a special conformal transformation? So what is, so the thing that matters is this guy, right? What is deep psi for a special conformal transformation? So. I said that the vector field for a special conformal transformation is quadratic in the coordinate. So that means that this guy is proportional in the x, right? So in order to have this be an invariance of your partition function, it means that this guy should be the second derivative of an operator so that I can integrate by part. Okay? So that tells you that p mu mu is d mu d nu l mu nu. So this is the official condition for to check whether your theory is conformal invariant. You look at your energy momentum tensor, you compute the trace. If it's not of this form, it is not. Now, the exercise that I will ask you to do this afternoon, I don't know where it is the following thing. So what I want to say is that the energy momentum tensor, or in general, the conserved current of a theory are not unique. You can add what are called improvement terms in such a way that the new current is still conserved and the charge is the same. Oh, so one thing I didn't say is that if you have a current, a conserved current like the energy momentum tensor, you can define a conserved charge essentially by integrating over space the time component of the kernel. So the exercise that you have to do this afternoon essentially is to show that I can redefine T mu nu into some other T hat T mu nu such that, so to redefine, okay, in a conformal field theory, which by definition means that it's invariant under special conformal transformations, I can define a new energy momentum tensor that such that it's traceless. Okay. So in a conformal field theory, I can always choose my energy momentum tensor so that it is traceless. And one way that you can see why let me first say it in this context. So if you have a current, I can always define a new current given a current by doing the following. So if I add to my current an operator which is a derivative of something, and this guy is antisymmetric in mu and nu, notice that the new current is also conserved, right? Because if I act with a derivative, this guy is antisymmetric and this will vanish. So the trick with the energy momentum tensor is that you can add to the energy momentum, symmetric energy momentum tensor, the following, these guys are called improvement terms. You can add the following thing. Let me put it. So you're gonna have d rho, d sigma, some operator y, mu rho, mu sigma, okay? You can easily show that this guy, okay, and you impose that this operator is antisymmetric in mu nu, antisymmetric in nu sigma, and given that this guy is symmetric in rho sigma, it is also symmetric under the exchange of these two guys. So this guy actually has exactly the same symmetries as those of the Riemann tensor. So you can see, I mean, by exactly the same logic here, this new energy momentum tensor is also conserved. Okay. So what I'm asking you to do in the lecture is to show that you can always find an operator if you start with a theory where T mu mu, what did it? Okay, I don't know what, P rho sigma, L rho sigma, that you can identify an operator of this type such that T hat hat mu equals zero. And one very useful way to construct this is the following, is that, as I said, the energy momentum tensor is constructed as the response of the theory to variation of the metric. So you can always add, when you construct the energy momentum tensor, you can add non-minimal couplings to curvature. To the metric, the background metric. Such that when you do the variation of those non-minimal couplings with respect to the metric and you evaluate it in flat space, you get a non-zero answer. And so what is the most general object I can write down whose first variation will survive in flat space? And there's a unique object in geometry that you can that has that property. So first you have your theory in flat space, you covariantize it in the usual way. Essentially, roughly speaking, you replace eta by a metric, right? But now I can add something. Okay, so eta replaced by g. I can add something that if I do the first variation with respect to the metric will not vanish. And the only object that you can write down is the Riemann tensor. Because the Riemann tensor, anything higher than Riemann tensor will be zero once you do the variation and evaluate it in flat space. But this guy will not be, okay? And there's a one-to-one correspondence between the space of improvements that I wrote here and the possible non-minimal couplings that you can write down of your conformal field theory to curve space. So in the exercise this afternoon, you have to construct essentially which term you can. So given the theory that has this property, which is the statement that it's conformal invariant, you can construct non-minimal couplings such that this is true. This is the exercise. OK, when we're over time, we'll continue tomorrow.